On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, I am joined by Kylie McDaniel of ESPN. He will be my guest host today. We're going to talk about the latest with Roki Sasaki, as well as a couple of signings from around the new year. Andrew McCutchen, Josh Bell, comparing the Pirates and Nationals. Then we have another special guest. It's Chris Cotillo, Red Sox beat writer, will talk to me about the Red Sox offseason so far and what they still have to do before they report to Fort Myers. Chris was great. So we got Red Sox chat, we got Sasaki chat, all that and more on this episode of Baseball Barbacast. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that hasn't met with Roki Sasaki yet, but we sent in our materials and surely we'll be hearing back from his representation soon. I'm Jordan Schusterman. Jake Mintz is still on the other side of the world. I am very excited to be joined by Kylie McDaniel of ESPN to guest co-host today. Kylie, my dear friend, how are you, my friend?
Doing great. Thanks for having me. It's been a long time between Barbacast appearances, but happy to be here.
That is correct and a good place to start. This episode, which as I mentioned, will not include the great Jake Mintz, who will return next week. Finally, he'll still be on the other side of the world, but he will start podcasting again next week. This episode features two longtime friends of the barbecue. Later on, you're going to hear my conversation with Chris Cotillo, the Red Sox beat writer for MassLive.com. That is actually the first time that I have podcasted with Chris, despite having been tweeting at him for over 10 years. But Kylie,
has Chris responded to you, or have you just been tweeting at him for 10 years?
See, it's funny you say that, because I was going back and looking at old Twitter interactions between us, and a lot of it is actually just us spamming him, and he just is ignoring us, even though he was in high school and being the more mature person. But you, Kylie, you're also someone that we have known for quite some time. But as you mentioned, it is a long time since we have had you on any iteration of our podcast. In fact, to my understanding, it has been almost 10 years. Do you know the last time we had you on the show and what we were talking about? Because I went back and listened to it last night and it was so funny.
Now I'm embarrassed. I did not realize it was 10 years. I would have guessed like 3 or 4. I have no idea what we would have talked. It was with that at the time when you guys were going to minor league games and I was watching College Team USA.
Yep, that's exactly right. So
Wait, hold on. A name just popped in my head. Was it about Luis Yonder Lao?
We did not talk about Luis Yonder Lao, although I do remember that very well. And I know we are off to a riveting start here.
People are clicking off immediately.
It was June of 2015.
Oh, man.
And we were talking about the 2015 draft, which is wild because that's Alex Bregman. That's Josh Naylor, who, you know, is now almost in free agency and was a surprise pick at the time. That's a bunch of pitchers you've never heard of. But the real takeaway from going back and listening to that OG Barbacast is that you sound exactly the same. You are giving the same, smart analysis and kind of reflections on the draft as if I'm talking to you now in 2025. And Jake and I sound like we're 10. I mean, it's a brutal, it's a brutal listen.
Like, just the timbre of your voice sounds that way, or like the information you delivered sounded that way?
All of it. I mean, you know, there were some like reasonably decent questions sprinkled in, but it was a tough listen. But the point is, Kylie dealt with us at that point, and now he is still a trusted industry friend and now an ESPN insider who is breaking news and has opinions on the world of baseball. So he figured like a good candidate for this guest host assignment.
I can pivot off of what you said, which is a game I like to play with my wife, which is, you know how you know I'm washed? And it's when when I meet people that are new in scouting, that are, you know, guys from like Prospects Live or Baseball America or whatever, that are younger, and, you know, we'll be chatting about like, when, you know, who's the best player you've seen when they were such and such, and we'll be like, I saw 15-year-old Juan Soto, or, you know, these like really old references. And like, they know that those are old references and I know those are old references, but it's like a player they've heard of. So it seems like they're connected to it, even though they were like in middle school when it happened. At one point, I was comparing a high school player that I was watching with one of these younger scouts, and I gave him a comp, and he looks at me and goes, "Who's that?" And I realized that player had already retired, but I had scouted them in high school.
Yeah, man.
And hey, I was like, listen, oh no, what have I done?
No, there's a few. And it's funny going back and listening to that at the time, you were referencing the 2006 draft, and I was like, bro, I can't help you on this one. Like,
you guys were nine when that happened.
Yeah, that's our age gap. But anyway, enough backstory. But it's nice to have you here, Kylie. I appreciate you taking some time on this Thursday morning. We are into 2025, and as we look ahead, we'll obviously Red Sox chat with Chris will be a big chunk of this episode, but. Our first topic today is what I believe will be the story of, like, yes, there are still big free agents out there like Pete Alonso and Alex Bregman, and those signings are certainly going to be compelling. But now that we are into January, the story of the offseason is Roky Sasaki. And that is our first topic. It is time for the opener. Roky Sasaki, Kylie McDaniel, this is someone who... I'm sure this is, as someone who follows amateur prospects and covers, a wide array of players at all levels, like this is, I'm sure, someone that was on your radar for a long time, but now we're here, we're getting to the end stages of this. And the reason we are talking about this now is because his agent, Joel Wolf, did a very informative session earlier this week where he spoke to the media and kind of gave an update as to where things are at. And I'll just kick it to you here. What were your biggest takeaways from here? I mean, we can kind of review them for those of you who haven't read the stories that come out of this. But he talked about 20 teams reached out. Do we think? Let's start there. Do we think he was that is an exact number, or do we think that he was being approximate and we are making too much of the fact that 10 teams didn't even bother to try and sign one of the most talented pitchers in the world for league minimum?
That to me was like almost the biggest takeaway from this, because like I know I was when I got the invitation to the thing, I was email or texting group text with all our ESPN reporters, and I was like, what do we think this is? And we were like speculating, like, oh, maybe he's narrowed it down to 10 teams or 8 teams and doesn't want to like have it filter out through leaks or whatever. The team's leaking it. He wanted to get in front of it. And it turned out it wasn't even that much. I think it was really just so many reporters wanted to talk to him. He didn't have time to talk to everyone individually. And so Joel wanted to sort of give an update. And there wasn't like a ton of like shocking information or like now the whole, the ball has moved forward or now at this point where there's 3 teams left and it's, whatever. But the idea that 10 teams didn't even try like seems completely ridiculous, because like at some point there are things in a front office where like arbitration, where like if you could outsource it to a law firm for whatever it is, $100 an hour or something, for someone else to do it for them, to free up your lower level to mid level baseball ops employees to then work on trades and other things like that, or R&D projects. It's probably a better use of your time. And some teams do that. I think not that many. But like the return on spending 100 baseball ops hours on making a presentation for Roky Sasaki to potentially, whatever it is, have a 1% chance of getting a $250 million value worth of a player, I'm like, pretty big return. Like, that's way more than arbitration. You can just throw arbitration out the window, spend some time on this.
Right.
Because I don't want to say reported, but like I had been told before this process started in like September that like he is not necessarily the like back of the tabloids, big city guy that's grown up in a high rise his entire life. There is some thought in the scouting community that he might prefer a lower profile situation. And some people interpreted that to mean, well, he'll be the 10th best player in the Dodgers or the Yankees, so that's lower profile. Or it could mean like a clubhouse where there's one beat writer instead of 17. Like maybe that's what he meant. Or smaller town. Or like, Giannis seems to like being in Milwaukee. Like it's not like all of these players want to just come to America and be in New York or LA, even though a lot of the players choose to do something like that. And so the idea that 10 teams wouldn't do it, like we were talking when that came out, I was like, all the teams that you would immediately think like, oh, that's a climate, a city, a part of the country that doesn't make any sense for him. One would be like Milwaukee. Like Milwaukee's a really well-run organization. Of course they would reach out to him. I'd be surprised if they didn't. So like, how would you get 10 teams to be like, it's not even worth 10 hours to like put in a PowerPoint presentation? Right. Like, how do you even get there?
Right. Because to that point, this unique situation where not only is the financial commitment so minuscule relative to his value, but, and Joel Wolf has been pretty consistent about this. I mean, you mentioned you're reporting through this, but he's said it up front. He said, listen, he's not focused exclusively on geography, exclusively on a history of Japanese players with the organization. Like, none of these things are most important for him. And so he's saying, like, give us your pitch. Like, if you think you are the team that can help him become the best pitcher in the world, which he wants to be, as Joel Wolf keeps saying, he has a long-term view of this. This is obviously not a financial decision. This is a, where can I thrive in Major League Baseball and become the best that I can be so that in however many years, he will sign some, you know, if he stays healthy and everything, probably the biggest contract we've ever seen for a pitcher. Obviously, this is so far down the road, but it is a very open landscape for this. And so to that point, 10 teams, that could be a fun guessing game on its own. But let's talk about who we do think is involved, unless you wanted to add one more thing on that.
Well, I was going to say also, it could be a team really likes their incoming international class. And so...
Sure. And I want to get to that.
Yeah, possibly having to renege on them. That's actually the reason. There could be a team that we think should be in the mix and would be like one of the top 10 landing spots that just don't want to engage in that process if they think it's a 1% chance. And then even then they'd have to get rid of all these players they like. Because there are teams that are committed to, you know, $2 million players that might actually be worth $10 million on the open market where they're like, well, that's a good value too. We kind of like that one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and that's a good point. And I do want to hit on that because I think that's the part of this story that still hasn't really been discussed very much because it is a little bit hard to talk about. So I want to make sure we get to that part. But let's focus on the teams that we have heard, not from Joel Wolf directly, because he did not confirm these are the teams that we met with. As you mentioned, if we were hoping for him to say we're down to this number of teams, the latest that we're at is basically, I mean, this is one of the quotes he said, the next steps will be something in the neighborhood of possibly meeting with one or two additional teams or narrowing the field, which I think may be more likely, and whether or not he wants to visit one or two cities as he tries to finalize the decision-making process. Our understanding is that Sasaki is now back in Japan after having spent a good amount of time in December in Los Angeles, meeting with teams at the Wasserman offices in California. Now, in terms of reported meetings that we've heard from teams, we've heard that the Dodgers, Yankees, Mets, Rangers, Giants, Cubs, and probably Padres, we can assume that has happened in some form. Now, none of those teams are, you know, any of the teams that we just kind of talked about, like, oh, hey, why wouldn't the Guardians try to get a Sasaki meeting? Or why wouldn't, you know, the small market team try? And it's possible those meetings have happened and we haven't heard about them, right? I mean, the reality is there probably have been more meetings than just these. And of course, a lot of these ones are the meetings when there are a lot of people covering them. And it's more likely that it would come out that that they would meet with them. And would you say that's probably a fair assessment, that it's more likely we're going to hear about the bigger market teams meeting with him than the ones that maybe are less likely?
Yeah, it's not surprising that like the first three teams you said, I think each of them have at least five beat writers. So there's a bunch of people trying to break news about a team when nothing is happening and they're all bugging their source. And all someone has to say is like, oh yeah, we met with them. And then it gets out. And like, that's probably good news for the team that it gets out that you met with them. So it's like, it's like a very low bar for that information to leak out. Whereas like we said, like Milwaukee or Cleveland, it's just like, that's a little harder. Not that those reporters aren't good or those teams don't want it out there. Maybe they're more secretive or not. But yeah, like the idea of it getting out for every team in these sorts of situations, there's a lot of like even the Corbin Burns thing was kind of surprising. And that didn't come together in like full view of the public. Like in a lot of ways those big contracts do, or like we hear they're closed 2 days before it gets announced or that it breaks and you kind of know what's going to happen. I never follow like the Vegas odds for these things, but I feel like they must get taken off the board 2 days early all the time when like someone says progressing toward deal with such and such. Like it's now like a 96% chance when someone reports that, one of the four or five people that are typically reporting those things.
Yeah, and I would say part of that too is, okay, as I alluded to in the intro, we've also had Dave Dombrowski and Craig Breslow doing press conferences about their other offseason activity, being asked like, hey, dude, you in on Sasaki? And he's like, we submitted. We have not had a meeting yet. That's something, right? I mean, that is the actual, you know, president of baseball operations telling you that we have not done it yet. Now, I guess they could be blatantly lying, but I didn't really know what benefit they would have to be doing that either. So that is also starting to whittle it down. And again, when we think back to the only other real recent precedent of this, which is the Ohtani situation, you know, if you remember that, I don't know how... Well, you remember that how that whole process went, but that did work where it was like this all happened over the span of like a week. It was a much more compressed amount of time. It was like he's posted at the beginning of December. And then a few days later, it was he's down to these eight teams. Because at the time, it was the same thing where like most of the league like sent, they wanted Ohtani, obviously. And then it came out like these are the teams that are left. Like it was very explicit, like these are the teams that are left. And at the time, the Angels were not, they were on the list, but no one was taking the Angels seriously.
Here's the one no one took seriously. Like, oh, I guess they're technically on there.
Right.
It's like when they leaked that like the number one pick in the draft, we're considering nine guys. It's like, I mean, they're considering three guys, but they put it six extra guys on there.
Right, exactly. Now, in this case, I don't, okay, let's do that. Of the teams that we've seen so far, and this can be based on your conversations, this can be based on what would be most surprising, like, you know, you could look and be like, oh, well, he's not interested in the Phillies or Red Sox, but he is interested in the Yankees and Mets. Okay, so East Coast, not a concern. Big market, not a concern. Like, what is he looking for? Is it weird that but then you could say, oh, Phillies and Red Sox, well, they don't have any spots in their rotation. Is he focused on, like, I am going to pitch immediately, right? Which, again, we assume talent-wise, this is someone that could pitch immediately, but I don't know if that would necessarily be the case.
He could be 2-3 innings at a time and sort of be like a opener slash reliever at the beginning. I mean, there's a situation where he could make 5 starts in AAA to kind of get his feet wet and that sort of thing. I guess if you take, like, the big question that hasn't been answered here is, why was he posted now? And so if you take a step back from that and you're like, all right, why would he be posted? What Joel Wolf has said, and I guess eventually Roki will say, is, you know, it was time for me to come over. I'm competitive. I want to be at the biggest league, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And, like, at some level, I believe that. But also, if you would have waited 2 years, you'd get $300 million. Like, why not wait 2 years when the other way around is come now and then wait 5 more years than you would have had to wait to then get the giant deal? So you would think his priority would not be short-term money. Like, if one of these teams wants to still sign a $2 million international signee and then give the rest of the money to him, the difference between 5 and 10, which is, you know, the lower end of what he could get and the high end of what he could get, I think 11 is, like, roughly 11 is, like, the most he could actually get. It's not really that big in terms of, like, he'll make that in, like, his second year of ARB or, you know, whatever.
Right.
And then a giant deal after that. So you would think his priority would be, I want to have a path to immediately be in the rotation, if not, like, on opening day, but, like, very quickly. I want to be on a team that's competitive so that I can pitch in important games that matter and have, like, an atmosphere and, like, a successful team. And I want to be able to get better so that when it is time for me to get that giant deal, that I get that giant deal. And so if you define it that way, like, a team that's competitive and, you know, maybe doesn't have the deepest rotation and then also is good at pitcher development, there's actually not that many teams that have, like, a track record of getting, like, Milwaukee's one of them, Cleveland's one of them. I would say the Dodgers and the Yankees qualify. I think David Stearns and the Mets qualify, but there's not, like, 20 teams that are, like, good at pitcher development. So that's, like, a smaller group. And then the ones that are actually competitive, that maybe knocks out a few. And then ones that don't have a full rotation maybe knocks out one or two, depending on how much that matters to him. And then maybe when it comes down to that, maybe then the things people were suggesting, like bigger market for marketing or has had some Japanese players or has some Japanese culture, maybe those things become a factor when he gets down to the 5 or 6 that meet the things that, you know, really matter. Those 2 or 3 things I just mentioned that I think matter. Like, obviously, we don't know. We're kind of guessing a lot. But I would imagine that's what he's looking for, is who can turn my 150 mil 7 years from now into 300 mil. And that, like, there's not that many teams that are, like, obviously good at that in the same way that we talk in the draft. Like, how many colleges are good at developing pitchers? You know, not very many. How many are good at developing hitters? Like, almost none of them. It becomes, like, very notable and is a real, like, sales pitch that works on recruits in high school and on free agency. Like, we've seen, like, San Francisco, when Farhan Zaidi was there, had no trouble signing 1- and 2-year deal guys because Rodon and Gausman and a lot of these guys went there, got a 1-year deal, got better, and then got the huge deal. So it was like, whether they wanted to stay there long term or not, this place can make you money. And that's not a super long list of teams.
Yeah. And to that point, though, again, when we compare it to Ohtani, you know, obviously Ohtani has said, oh, well, we still are like, why did you pick the Angels? Oh, okay, I just had a feeling. But also, the two-way element at the time was also significant, right? We still didn't have the universal DH. The Angels clearly were the team that were going to let him do whatever he wanted on all fronts. And that was great. Credit to them. It worked out. They were correct, right? There were a lot of teams that were like, is he really going to, can he really hit? I mean, all this is hilarious now in retrospect. But, like,
remember that panic when he couldn't hit after, like, 3 bad spring training games?
What is it, Jeff? What was the Passan article headline? The verdict is in. Ohtani sucks at hitting or something.
And to be fair, he did look bad in those 3 games.
Yeah,
and I think there is, like, a chat that exists at that point where somebody asked me, can this guy hit? And I'm like, I don't know. He's like a 20-year-old dominating the MPB. Like, maybe we will just, like, take more than 3 games. Like, I think it was, like, a little hasty. And in retrospect, that looks better now. But if you would have given me 20 bad AAA games, I might have been like, maybe this guy can hit. What do I know?
Yeah, but either way, the reason I bring that up is that now, in terms of when we know it's not a financial motivation, at least in the short term. Okay, so, like, where can he, if we put it in Ohtani terms of, like, where can he do the thing that he wants to do, which is become the best pitcher? Like, yeah, I think we have to take the pitching development track record thing seriously as a priority. And you can, you know, we can talk about who those teams are. The one team I want to focus on, though, before we get to just, like, the bigger picture thing about the international free agent class and how this process is going to work, because I think there was some other insight from Joel Wolf that is interesting into how this might play out in the coming weeks, is the Padres. The Padres, to me, feel like they are in, and I am looking forward to talking more about the Padres in the coming weeks, but, like, they are, as far as who needs Roki Sasaki the most, not just the one who has been connected the most. I mean, I have to say that they, because of their situation and because of the financial difficulties that they seem to be navigating in terms of a lot of their long-term contracts and even some of the shorter-term ones, that if they are going to do anything this offseason, like, that is the one where plugging in the pitcher on league minimum would create, obviously that would give benefit to a lot of teams, but listen, the Dodgers do not need Rogi Sasaki right now. They don't.
At one point,
right?
last season, if you took everyone on the IL, they had 15 good major league starting pitchers. Exactly. And I was like, that might be too many guys. Like, when they all get healthy, which if they ever do, like, you know, God help us. But that, that's too many guys.
Yeah, but and you could even say the same thing about the Yankees to some degree. And so while every team could use Sasaki and should want Sasaki, the Padres feel uniquely like landing him would be so important towards just like the overall health and direction of the franchise, because of like the flexibility that it gives you to make other trades, to feel good about the status of your rotation that right now is, you know, Darvish, Cease, who's on the trade block, Michael King, who's awesome, but again, not under long-term contract. And then like Matt Waldron and who knows what else, right? And they don't seem to have the money right now to be able to do anything about that. And so Sasaki is like, he would just immediately be their 2, 3, 4 starter, whatever. And they've, of course, been talking about him openly for a long time. That's the team to me, not that we haven't already talked about Padres and Sasaki's possibility, but as far as just who needs him the most, that's the one that stands out by far of the ones who seem likely. But I don't know if there are other teams that kind of stand out.
Yeah, if you want to try to guess in the same way that Ohtani picked the Angels because like he had a good feeling and they basically didn't give him any restrictions and they kind of needed him the most of the teams that seemed attracted to him, the Padres definitely need him the most. And if you want to then use that as a proxy for, well, now their pitch will be the most effective, they will try the hardest to do the recruiting stuff, like they're a team that's built around stars, like God forbid they get one more, they also have DeVries and Salas on the way, but they also don't have Robbie Snelling and Adam Mazur and those guys they traded for rental Tanner Scott, who's already out the door. This fits what they need. And then also AJ Preller, if you could rank all 30 GMs, like who is most likely to throw a ton of resources into this just in general to get a really good player for a low price that's like a potential star, he'd probably be number one. Plus, he really needs this guy. And they, like, you know, they have Yu Darvish, who sounds like there is like some, you know, connection there personally between him and Sasaki. This could also open up Japan to them even more than it currently is for other free agent players. Like, this would be such a huge coup for them that I have to assume that they're coming with the best pitch, with the most sort of comprehensive book of things of the, Joel Wolf called it the Roki Film Festival. I'm like, I'm assuming that whatever he said was the most impressive, all of them were from the Padres because they are incentivized and have the people that would do this sort of thing that would, you know, the Dodgers, it wouldn't necessarily change the like outlook for the franchise. Like they would probably still think about them the same way. With the Padres, it could change the franchise.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. And I'm glad you mentioned, right. Obviously, Wolf talked about the pitches that teams are sending in, and the other interesting detail that Sasaki requested that no players were involved in this first round of meetings. Now, that doesn't mean that he suddenly forgets that he has a relationship with Yu Darvish. It just means that he's not, you know, necessarily present in that first meeting, and I think that that's a compelling little detail. But to your point, I mean, that's why I feel, and the reason I bring them up specifically, because, you know, when we first had Yuri on to talk about Sasaki's history and the connection and Dodgers Padres that we've speculated about, we've talked about it as just like, oh, okay, what's most likely all these connections to make. But if you zoom farther out and you think about the direction of the franchise and you think about the offseason the Padres are having right now, which is one that hasn't existed. They have done literally nothing.
It's almost like they don't know what they need yet, so they don't want to spend any money until they know what they need.
Exactly. And Sasaki is clearly a much higher... And I understand the point of people saying, like, Sasaki, because he's not going to cost any money, should not be dictating what teams are doing. And I do kind of agree with that. Like, that does seem a little silly because it's not like he's some big financial outlay. But I have to imagine if there's any team that is basically waiting to see how this plays out to know exactly how, what degree they need to pivot... It's the Padres, because I mean, like Dylan Cease, like, okay, great. You want to try to get his last year of his contract off and flip him for something. I mean, I just told you what the rotation situation is now. Like, if you're going to trade Dylan Cease, you better be getting back another young pitcher who's going to immediately help you right now.
Well, I was going to say, like, for instance, let's say that the Padres sign Sasaki on, you know, whatever it is, January 16th. And then the next day can trade Cease to Baltimore for, this is not reporting, but hypothetically, Cade Povich and Heston Kerstad. Mm-hmm. that changes what their needs are. Like, they would be dumb for them to go spend money on a guy in free agency when they're going to get like a starting outfielder and a starting pitcher, maybe their fifth or sixth starting pitcher, and then Sasaki will be the fourth one. It's like, well, now maybe you don't need a starting pitcher, or you need a different kind of starting pitcher, and now you don't, maybe you don't need Profar as much. Like, it would have been silly to do all that at the beginning.
And you can apply this to these other teams that are involved, whether that is the Yankees, whether that's the Mariners, right? Whether it's like, okay, great, if we could somehow get Sasaki, now Castillo, sweet, we can trade him and then try to do something else. Whether that's the Cubs, who, you know, how much are they, is Matthew Boyd really all they're going to add to the rotation? Like, okay, well, maybe now you do this and that gives you some more wiggle room to do something else. The Rangers are another team. I just talked about this on the last episode. What is the status of their rotation? Like, is that something that they actually feel good about? Or is that something that they're still clearly trying to add to or not? Because while there are dwindling options in terms of starting pitchers on the available at this point, you might as well maybe see if you're going to get Sasaki, and that will probably dictate whether you go after Nick Pivetta or go after, you know, Jack Flaherty or something like that. I think now we're at the point where teams probably are going to wait. So that brings us to our last kind of point here, which is how this is actually going to play out timeline-wise. So the international signing period opens on January 15th. That is a day. Generally, now this is used to be July 2nd, but now January 15th is when the international period opens. You know, historically, that's a day when we hear about all these deals with the top players from Venezuela, Dominican Republic, and Cuba, and Colombia, and all these guys are going to sign. And that's still going to happen, right? That is still going to happen. Even though the headlines are going to remain about Roki Sasaki, on January 15th, like, we are going to find out that all these amazing shortstops and outfielders and all these are signing with these teams. Obviously, those deals have all largely already been agreed to. Joel Wolf said that he doesn't necessarily think he's going to sign immediately on January 15th. Now, that could change, right? I mean, this next round of meetings could change that in some form. I think the fear from people talking around the league about how this is going to be messy in terms of, okay, if I have to commit X amount of million to Sasaki, that means I can't sign, you know, this Venezuelan outfielder. I think some people have wondered, okay, if he hasn't signed yet, there's going to be multiple teams waiting. That's where it becomes problematic, I feel like, because in my head, if he has decided by January 15th and the team knows, that's one team that is going to obviously, unfortunately, have to, you know, renege on some deals, but that's one team. Whereas, do you see a scenario where if he's not signed on January 15th, that like we don't see X number of top signings happen on January 15th the way we historically do? Because that is obviously not what the league is going to want, even though it seems like the league preferred to have him be a part of this period instead of last period. And he also preferred that as well.
Yeah, I'm super interested in like the choreography of how this is going to happen.
Yes.
Like, I think ideally, like for the whole league, he chooses on like January 13th, a team that has 2 days to set up the trades that you can start doing on January 15th. The team that is going to be acquiring the pool space from, they're going to know that it's Sasaki based. And so then does the price go up dramatically? Does another team come in at a more reasonable price? Does that team have to use their entire pool plus the full allotment that they could trade for above that? Is it like, oh, the Mets got him, but like they are committed to maybe the best player in the international period. Can they trade for the maximum amount, pay that player what they were going to pay him, and then get rid of the rest of the players below him, and then get Sasaki and Elian Pena? Like, I have no idea how that's going to work. And I would imagine at some point, if Sasaki says, this is the team, this is definitely the team, and the team's like, the number's five, that's what we can give you, he's probably just going to say yes. But
that's,
if he's
that's
like,
my thinking, yeah.
Yeah, what if they narrow it down to three, and he's like, which one of the three wants me the most? It's like, if the Padres will give me $11 million, then it'll be them. And yeah, if the Mets are going to give me five, then that's like how much they want me and how much they'll prioritize me. We have no idea if he'll do that either. Maybe he won't.
Right. We have to hope, and this is what's so hard, because this isn't Joel Wolf and Roki Sasaki's responsibility. Like, it's so difficult, because this is the system, and the system is flawed, and there's problems with it, and the deals, like, it's so messy and challenging to talk about, but it's also not Roki Sasaki's fault, and he shouldn't be making decisions based on these other situations. But this is also the system in which he is operating, and so to that point, I'm just so curious, what does that look like?
Because we've no precedent for this. The Ohtani thing was late in the period, and it was just whatever you have, give to him, and that number varied from whatever it was, 2 to 4 million, and so it was the money just didn't matter. It was just whatever you have, I'll take it. And now it's completely open. It could be kind of anything.
It could be kind of anything, but we keep saying, oh, it doesn't matter. Do teams, will they need to trade for more? Or is that kind of you know, antithetical to what Joel Wolf said, which is that the difference between those millions doesn't matter. Because if that's true,
and it shouldn't seems, in the span of like what Roki's going to make in his career, like it is irrelevant. But do you want to be like David Stearns and being told you can offer him 11 or you can offer him 5? Do you really want to find out if a yes turns into a no from 11 to 5? It's like, well, no, you don't, but you'd like to find out what it is.
And as you mentioned, the leverage involved in those trades becomes very messy. Now, even at the time with Ohtani, there were teams that were trading for bonus base that didn't end up getting Ohtani. I mean, that Mariners did that. I think there were a couple teams that did that.
I mean, didn't the Dodgers trade for bonus base in the past period that everyone thought was for Sasaki and ended up like obviously not being for that?
Right. So that's the thing. Like, I want, as I just mentioned, like, obviously you understand the system well and you could explain it. But to your point, like, you're just as curious as the rest of us.
Well, because it's not like this happens every year. And so we know how this works. Because it's like, even Joel Wolf doesn't know, like, how to advise Sasaki on how to make this decision. Because this has literally never happened before. Because the system changed since Ohtani did it. And the Ohtani timing, as we said, was also different. And that's the only guy that is even close to the same as this. And then everyone knows that that outcome was $700 million. And I think there's also like this like unspoken assumption that this guy will also be worth $700 million. And like, he probably won't. Like, he's a pitcher. Like, it's just going to be a little bit different. And there's a chance that he's like, I don't know, like any one of these players that is heavily hyped that ends up being just pretty good. Like, if he ends up being a, you know, Taiwan Walker, that's going to be a huge letdown. That's still a nice player you'd like to have, but maybe not worth blowing up your entire thing.
Taiwan Walker was good, by the way, at some point.
Yeah, but like, that, I would say that's like a, you know, 30th percentile outcome. It's like a pretty good player that signs for $100 million over his entire career. But like, that would be a giant letdown, even though that's like a really nice guy to have. If that guy comes out of your international program, you're like, what a success.
Right. When you're comparing the investments to the, you know, teenage shortstop in Venezuela, that's kind of what you're discussing. So again, I hope that I'm excited about it. I'm curious about it. I hope that the day of excitement for all of the amateur players in Dominican and Venezuela is not overshadowed by this. I know it will be to some degree, but the timing will certainly impact it. Again, it's not Joel Wolf's responsibility. I'm very curious how this goes, and we'll see. Right, January 15th is the earliest. His posting window closes on January 23rd, so we know it can't be any later than that. But I have to imagine it'll be at some point close to that. So we'll see. Maybe next week's round of meetings get us a little bit more clarity, and we do arrive a little bit closer to a conclusion. But January 15th will be the earliest we have an official answer. All right, Kylie, let's take a quick break. When we return, you'll hear my conversation with Red Sox beat writer Chris Cotillo, and then Kylie will return. We'll hit some smaller moves before we say goodbye. We'll be right back on Baseball Buzz Cast. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. I am now joined by Chris Cotillo. You may know him as the Red Sox beat writer for MassLive.com, the co-host of the Fenway Rundown podcast. I will always know him as the high schooler that broke the Doug Fister trade. Chris, welcome to Baseball Barbacast.
It is a pleasure to be here after all this time. And a reminder, trade deadliner is gone but not forgotten.
Before we get into some Boston Red Sox stuff, we have to have a little bit of reflection here, Chris, because we have been tweeting at each other for over 10 years. I was doing some advanced Twitter searching leading up to this conversation and realizing how remarkable it is that we are both still lucky enough to be doing this. Because when Jake and I first started blabbering into microphones, you were tweeting scoops as a high schooler. And that was the thing. We were like, oh my God, this is hilarious. Who is this Chris Cotillo guy? And you were, for a long time while we were in college and then you were in college, it was just like, oh my God, Chris Cotillo, he's the one guy younger than us and he's doing the job for real. And now here we both are still doing the job for real, but definitely still doing two very different jobs. Do you miss your scoop life? I know you're still on the hunt for scoops, but now very specific scoops.
It's a good question. You know, in the off season, I always, you know, think about, you know, being a high schooler, being a college kid and how good it felt to get that one major league signing a winter and then realizing how much time I spent chasing down so many others that, you know, Passan got or Heyman got or Rosenthal got, and thinking like, you know, at a certain point, like, it's, you know, you're so close so many times and just feel like those guys, because they're so good at what they do, end up getting 99%. So, you know, covering one team, I think, has its benefits. Obviously, You know, I think it's funny sometimes I'll tweet out like a random minor league signing for some other team, or I'll hear something because I still do talk to a lot of the people around the league that I always did. And someone will say, oh, wow, like you're cheating on the Red Sox, like you're breaking something outside of the Red Sox.
No.
It used to be the other way around. But, you know, the moral of the story here, Jordan, is I'm washed, you're washed, Jake is washed. And, you know, it used to be a novelty thing, these kids in the big city on Twitter. Now we're just washed, you know. There's a lot of people that are more popular than us, younger, more hip, all of the above. And here we are doing a podcast on a Thursday morning at 9 a.m.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, I'm turning 30 in a couple months, and it's over. It's over for both of us. But as long as we get to keep doing this, this is cool, because the real momentous part of this is we have not done a podcast together, which is pretty astonishing. And you've kind of held this over us at many winter meetings over the years. And we decided finally, with Jake still in Thailand, to rectify that. So I appreciate you coming on. And fortunately, the Red Sox have given us enough to talk about to where we did, this isn't too forced. I mean, this is a team that we have already been talking about.
When you say he's still there, was it planned to be this long, or is he not let back in the United States?
No. He continues to extend his trip, actually. He's going to be gone even longer than expected. But my understanding is
he went straight from the winter meetings there, right?
Yes. Yeah. No, he went.
And that's like December 8th.
That was a long time ago. A lot of transactions have occurred since then. Mm-hmm. And he's still got a few more weeks, many time zones away. But no, Jake, we'll continue to let him enjoy his lengthy honeymoon. I am here to talk to you about those Boston Red Sox, who you are exclusively focused on now as part of your job. And we, you know, at the start of the offseason, as the start of the last few offseasons, it's like, okay, the Red Sox, they should be a team we are talking about. And then they have not really been that, or at least they have been in sort of a negative way. And at least so far, I know that you and your co-host Sean McAdam on the Fenway Rundown podcast have been very, very clear about how, while they have been active and they have made some very impressive, you know, savvy moves that have improved the roster, it's still unclear how much of a step forward this has really been based on the expectations set out and based on the money that we really were kind of hoping, or I know a lot of Red Sox fans were hoping to see them spend. So let's just start there before we kind of go into certain parts of the team. Where does that come from? Is that fair? Because I think a lot of neutral fans, a lot of fans of teams who have quite literally done zero, are looking at this Boston Red Sox roster and saying, all right, like they have added some pretty good players. So at this stage, as we flip to January now, do you consider this a successful offseason so far, or do you still identify it as like a lot of work left to do?
Yeah, I mean, the big shock here is New Englanders being impatient. Who would have ever seen that one coming? Because I couldn't have. I think, you know, it's just, and that's the way they are. It's what makes Red Sox fans great. They're educated, informed. They don't take BS. We saw that last year with the full throttle comment, and they haven't, you know, let ownership and Tom Werner and Sam Kennedy and everybody live that down in, you know, a year plus now. And they were promised, you know, the same thing of, you know, going kind of, if not all in, pretty close to deliver a team capable of winning the AL East. And to this point, I mean, they've made, let's probably call it the biggest trade, you know, that anybody's made for Crochet. And they've added a guy in Buehler who can be really, really good when healthy and when at his best. So your rotation is, I think, a lot better than it was last year, you know, where Tanner Houck was an all-star and the ace in the first half. And he is, you know, your number three, your number four heading into next year. I think that the leaps are big in terms of the rotation. So, yes, I like Crochet. I like Buehler. From a baseball perspective, Aroldis Chapman does make them better. I do think that it is just the start of what their offseason should be. They still need a bat. They could still use a relief arm. And as we get here to January 2nd, I think fans, and you know, as we talked about on our pod the other day, Sean and I, like, people anticipated that, you know, maybe more money would have been spent to this point. To me, Crochet, you get that done via a trade. You get Buehler done in the one-year pillow deal. You get Chapman instead of Tanner Scott for a much cheaper salary. Okay, now you have the room to go kind of do whatever you want on the free agent market. And I've been saying all along, you know, blowing away Teoscar Hernandez with a big offer was always the easiest thing. It would be a great fit. He'd be perfect at Fenway. He'd be perfect on this team. I don't think, made him an offer, which is a very, very confusing aspect of this. And now, you know, as they get to, you know, the second half of this offseason, it's a little unclear where they go from here.
Yeah, and you know, free agency is obviously a two-way street. It's easy for us to say, like, well, yes, they obviously could have afforded to pay him a lot more than mm-hmm. the Dodgers did. And, you know, maybe we will learn more about those negotiations. The fact that to your understanding, they didn't make an offer is pretty stunning because of how obvious he appeared to fit
right.
what they needed. But
I mean,
that point,
as you said, there's a legitimate chance they were just resigned to, hey, I'm only talking to the Dodgers. I'm going back there sure. no matter what, which a sure. lot of people did think about him.
Sure.
But, you know, why not try is my
yeah.
question.
Yeah, no, that's valid. And I want to get back to the pitching more specifically, especially with some of the recent news, Giolito talking about, you know, being ready for opening day and the concept mm-hmm. of six-man rotation. I want to get to that in a second. But the money aspect is interesting to me because you're trading, now they trade a lot of prospects, right? But, I mean, Crochet's barely making anything. And we talk about Buehler being that one-year deal. I mean, they haven't, from what I can tell, based on what was coming off the books, guys who are hitting free agency and what they've added, they haven't added any money, like, at all. And I know you've mentioned they're still about $25 million or so away from that first, you know, luxury tax line. Obviously, the luxury tax line was unfortunately a big part of the Red Sox discourse, some of which was their own fault, some of which not. Mm-hmm. Is that still considered? Like, I think we were thinking when we were talking about the beginning of the offseason, with the Juan Soto stuff, like, clearly they were ready to go. And we've talked about this with teams like the Yankees, who clearly, once they missed out on Soto, it's like, all right, here we go. Time to right. spend big in other ways. The Red Sox, we have not seen them do that yet. And to your point, they're kind of running out of options to do so. So there is still time left for them to do that. And you mentioned Tanner Scott, the relief market has barely moved at all. So to that point, like, do you still envision them get it going? I mean, that's the game here. It's like, how do you spend another $30 million? So it shouldn't be that hard, but do you still think that there is that part of their offseason left?
I mean, they did, you know, they offered $190 to Fried. So, yeah. you know, they were trying to spend, and they right. pivoted to Crochet, and they just, you know, they liked both guys. They mm-hmm. could have probably gotten both guys if they, you know, obviously signing Fried wouldn't have ruled them out on Crochet because, you know, dipping into different, you know, parts of what you're spending. So, you know, Bregman, I think, looms as the guy that fans are excited about. He's still the top guy on the market. To me, I think it's an interesting fit, but one that's not, you know, the cleanest in a lot of ways. It's a guy that I think, you know, has shown signs of decline. There is obviously the relationship with Alex Cora, which is now a good one. That's not always been the case, but Cora is vouching for him and wants him. And I do think they'd benefit from an adult in the room, a guy who's won championship pedigree. All that stuff is worth something. Is it worth $200 million? I don't know. Just because they have, I mean, so many of these guys that you're going to theoretically need spots for, you know, whether it be Story for either, you know, I think he has an opt-out after this year, but assuming he doesn't exercise that, you know, a couple more years, Marcelo Meyer and Campbell coming up, you know, if you sign Bregman to play second, you're effectively giving up on the whole Vaughn Grissom thing after a year, which, you know, like, maybe they should. David Hamilton, you know, had flashes last year. You have all these guys where you figure, you know, you could find two guys up the middle and you're kind of clogging that situation even a little bit more. And I've said since day one of the offseason, the whole move Devers, trade Casas, reconfigure everything is kind of doing too much work for a team that's, you know, set in the infield corners. You would be, I think, selling low on Casas, who I think has the chance to be an elite player. People, Red Sox fans always like give me the crazy side eye when I say that because he hasn't stayed on the field and he talks a lot. And so therefore, you know, you can't say he has that potential, but he does. He's not viewed at the same level as Roman Anthony and some of those guys as prospects right now because he's been in the big leagues for a couple of years. But the upside is, you know, probably right there still that young. And I think pissing off Devers, moving him off third, shaking everything up, you know, angering your $300 million player 2 years into the extension. Like, there's just a lot of moving parts where I would leave that alone. So Bregman at second is the only path where that would make sense, but still, it clogs everything up. To me, like, that's what made Teoscar such a good yeah. fit. You know, you overpay him for 2 years or three. He comes in, DHs a lot, plays some outfield. You know, you get rid of Yoshida somehow to make that happen. It, you know, Tyler O'Neill secondarily doing that would have made some sense. He obviously goes off the board earlier. So they still need that bat. They're still very left-handed. Is it, you know, a very underwhelming for fans, Randall Grichuk? Is it a, you know, a trade with the Cubs for Suzuki? Like, how are they going to do it? I don't know, but they have to find a way. I mean, they were like 17 and 27 or something against left-handed starters last year. Yeah. And, you know, if you look at the lineup, you know, from the top, from Duran and the guys at the top to Rafi and Casas and Roman Anthony coming up and Abreu and all these guys, a lot of left-handed hitters, and they got to fix that problem.
So let's, I do want to find my way back to the rotation, but since you're on this, like, I'll just generally say, like, I love Bregman. I think he would be a great fit there, even though, to your point, it does complicate a lot of things, even if he is playing second base. I think the way Alex Cora talked about him at the winter meetings, like explicitly being like, yeah, I always thought he was going to be a second baseman. I thought he'd be a good second baseman. I thought that was really compelling. So clearly, I think that would be what it would be. That would also require Alex Bregman to want to do that, which it seems like he would. And ultimately, with him at this point, it is going to probably just come down to what offer he ends up getting. So Bregman aside, I think Grichuk would be a good fit, even though I understand why Red Sox fans would roll their eyes at that. He's certainly coming off a great season. One of those players that's coming up is right-handed, and that is Christian Campbell. And I don't necessarily want to focus on Campbell too much specifically, but I think that this next wave of players is really important to how they operate here, because you see Red Sox fans kind of bouncing back and forth between sign all these guys, you know, let's just blow into the luxury tax, let's get Bregman, let's get all these at the start of the offseason, Soto, blah, 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 blah. And then now you have kind of the pivot of like, screw it, like, let's just play the kids, like Anthony and Campbell should be there on opening day. Positionally, and Campbell's a right-handed hitter, Anthony's left-handed hitter, both of them finished with really strong, obviously two of the best players in the minor leagues last year. Campbell, I'm excited to just like talk about more this upcoming season. I don't want to go into his whole backstory, but he is right-handed and he does fit in a couple places positionally. Do you have a sense for the organization's comfort level? And spring training is, of course, going to dictate this a lot. But do you have a sense for which one of them is closer, or are they both kind of on that same timeline and either of them could maybe win a spot in camp this year?
Yeah, I think. Believe it or not, you know, the path is probably easier for Campbell, even though he has, you know, just basically, you know, that was his first pro season. He was drafted the year before, because they have tried, like, we did this in the press box one day, must have been a blowout, but we were, you know, taking guesses on how many guys they have tried at second base since Pedroia went down.
Yeah.
And like went down for good. And I guess 17, and he played a handful of games at 18 and 19, but cycling back to Brock Holt, Eduardo Nunez, and Ian Kinsler in 18, they tried like 30, 35 different guys at second base over 7 years. The leader in games, a guy that I liked a lot as a player and a person, Christian Arroyo, but, you know, not a guy that was a bona fide starter at that spot. So they've been trying to figure out that problem for, you know, the entire time I've been on the beat. Last year, Emmanuel Valdez led them in appearances there. He's no longer on the team. He was DFA'd for Carlos Narvaez, to give you an example of where their second base situation stands. I mean, that's why I think Campbell has a better chance. You know, in the outfield, they're still crowded with Abreu, Duran, Raffaello, Ref Snyder. Yoshida has played outfield in the past, obviously, though they didn't let him last year. So Campbell, I think, has that chance. To me, I always thought there was a case to be made that you trade Campbell right now because it's hard to see him possibly having greater value than he does right now. You know, one of the great helium seasons we've seen in the minor leagues across baseball the last few years, a guy that went from a fourth round pick to that in a year. Like, is there a chance that you trade this guy who's got so much hype around him at the peak of his powers? To me, that made some sense. They obviously decided to trade, you know, Teal and Montgomery instead, as they're kind of blue chippers for Crochet. But I think he'll have a chance to make the team, and I think Anthony will be, you know, right behind him, especially if one of these other guys does get moved. I think everybody thought Abreu was going to get moved to start the offseason. Really, there's no reason and no rush to do that. He's like 24, just won a gold glove. I think in this kind of age of kind of prospect loving, we all kind of like lose track of the guy who has major league success. That's kind of the point with Casas I was making, but also, like, you know, Willie Abreu and Roman Anthony, people look at him, oh, give me Roman Anthony. Well, with no disrespect to him, and he has all the tools, he's played 0 seconds in the majors, and you're Abreu exactly right. Has won a gold glove in the major leagues, right?
Yeah.
And he's hit.
And hit well.
He can't hit. Right.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
To me, there's something to that.
You're absolutely right. And as a prospect hugger and lover myself, it's easy to be like, oh my God, like give me the Red Sox. I mean, their future is undeniable. I mean, they're going to have the best lineup in baseball, obviously.
You could have said that about Henry Owens and Blake Swihart too.
And that's the other thing, especially with some of these bigger market, this happens with the Yankees too. Like you just like, oh, well, that guy's obviously going to be an all-star immediately. It's like, probably not.
Exactly.
He's right. Probably not. So the odds of all these guys working out, and we'll see if some of the ones that end up working out or not working out are now on the White Sox. You know, obviously this group of Red Sox prospects are going to be ones we're watching for a long time. But that is interesting about Campbell, and I agree, it is hard to imagine his profile. Whereas Anthony, I feel like it's been a little bit of a slower build, and he's more widely considered. I mean, he's someone that scouts have known since he was a sophomore in high school. It's like Roman Anthony, of course. He's a guy who goes up and down, and then now he's really become that star outfield prospect. So I imagine we'll see both of them
people,
at some point.
People rightly in free agency always ask, you know, why are teams so terrified to give up a comp pick to sign a guy? Both of those guys were comp picks. So that's right. I hate that line of thinking, but that gives you some
credence to
the whole idea.
I know, and then you can apply that too to the Red Sox right now. Oh, well, are they unwilling to sign someone with the QO and give up a pick, even if, as you guys have pointed out, they are going to get a pick back when Nick Pivetta signs elsewhere?
It's like they're not going to get a prospect better than these guys with this comp pick, so just give it up, you know? Like, there's no chance.
No, I agree with that. That's like, you've already done pretty well here, you know, at some point.
That's
there
why
is
they
probably
didn't take a Rule 5 guy this year. They got Whitlock, they got Slayton, they said, we can't, we're at the peak with that, and we're done.
Right. It's good. If you're not taking Rule 5 picks, that probably means your roster's in a decent place.
That's right.
So that is not necessarily a bad thing, as much as I love the Rule 5. Let's finish on the rotation, because, I mean, I have like a million Yoshida questions, and like Rafaela, where does he fit in? They extend him, all those things. But I want to kind of apply the Rafaela curiosity to Brian Baio. Because I think right now with the Red Sox rotation, a lot of the conversation, Breslow hinting at maybe a six-man rotation, you have pointed out, and I don't think we need to rehash this because I think it's true, and we've seen it across the league, pitchers are going to get hurt. Yes, you could say six-man rotation in the beginning of or at the end of December. Maybe that is what happens. Maybe it's not. Guys are going to get hurt. That's all true. But I also just want to focus on who's already there, because you mentioned Tanner Houck. Him and Carter Crawford were two of the best pitchers in baseball for the first month last year, and then it all went very wrong. Brian Baio, my understanding is he had the opposite season. He finished much stronger. And so when you factor in Giolito, we've already mentioned Crochet and Buehler, of course, the new guys. But when we talk about how good this rotation is, like, I'm just as curious about the incumbent pitchers here. And I'm curious where you're at in terms of optimism and where the organization feels as how good those guys are. Because, my God, if you're getting the first half version of Tanner Houck and the first half version of Carter Crawford, and is Carter Crawford, like, if Lucas Giolito is battling for a rotation spot, as he said he's willing to do, is that with Crawford? Like, I'm curious where you could imagine it fleshing out if all the guys make it through spring training healthy, which we acknowledge is unlikely.
Yeah, I mean, this is a good problem to have for a team that's had the opposite problem for so long.
Yeah.
And you're not even, you know, like, Garrett Whitlock's on the roster. I think he's probably slated for the bullpen, and I think he should be at this point. Richard Fitz is a guy that, you know, came in. People in Boston don't use his full name because it's a lot funnier to go the other way, but I do because I'm a professional. He's a guy that, you know, pitched well down the stretch. They are excited about Quinn Priester. Cooper Criswell, Tar Heel, pitched well for them last year as well for, you know, I think he made 18 starts and was good. So they are like eight, you know, nine deep in the rotation.
Yeah, definitely not a problem. I mean, to be clear, this isn't, I'm not framing this as like, oh, what are they going to do with all these guys? But like, I'm curious about the guys at the top, like, where's your optimism level? Because Baio, especially having committed to him, like, what is the path forward to him?
Well,
is he going to end up the three or the five or what?
Before that, like, the fact that we're talking about, you know, Giolito competing for a spot, or they gave him $21 million last year, like, on a 1-year deal, and now that carries over, and so they're paying this guy 2 for $40 to compete. Like, you know, he's going to be in the mix. He's got a long track record. They were excited about him. You know, Baio, to me, it was a little bit of physical stuff in April. I think he had a lat strain that sidelined him for like 2 weeks, and then a lot of mental stuff where he had these just blow up innings where you could just see, you know, the train coming off the tracks. I think, really, you know, in a few places, one of them in Chicago against the White Sox, where no pitcher should be able to allowed to implode last year. And with Houck and Crawford, I think it was just, you know, kind of hitting the wall of being so good, you know, so early. Houck had one blow up start at home against the Padres that was really bad. Crawford had a stretch of like 12 homers and three starts, including five in LA. The ball that Ohtani hit has not come down yet, and that was July. But otherwise, I mean, when you're getting 30 starts out of those guys, I think, you know, that's a good place to start. And when you're able to shift those guys from like 1-2-3 to 3-4-5 or 4-5-6, that, you know, really takes a lot of pressure off all of them. But I do think, to your point, like, if you were to talk to Red Sox fans, the front office, all this stuff a couple years ago, heading into last year, this is how they, you know, the guy they gave the extension to, the opening day starter, was Brian Bello, who probably has more upside than, you know, Houck or Crawford, even if the results have not been there. You know, Bello is a guy that a lot of people thought could be a number two, a number one, and he's still super young. We've seen kind of tantalizing stuff over time. I think it's just learning how to attack a lineup and learning how to get through a game that he's, you know, kind of struggled with at times. It's not, you know, linear for every pitcher. Remember, Tanner Houck's been around since, you know, late 2020.
Oh, it's been a while.
And so he's, you know, and it's only been since the middle of 22 for Bello, and kind of that for Crawford too. So I think, you know, if you have three homegrown guys who made 30 starts that can slot in as your 3, 4, 5, and 6, along with Giolito, and then have what Crochet and Buehler can do, I mean, there's a ton of upside there. They're overcompensating with depth because they haven't had it in years past.
Yeah.
And we've seen, you know, the Connor Siebolds of the world make starts for this team in the last couple of years. You won't have to do that again.
2020 Red Sox were quite the experience. They got you Marcelo Meyer, one of the great tank jobs in baseball history. Never forget, right? But that said, every time Jeffrey Springs is like dominating, I'm like, oh my God, this guy.
when your number three starter to enter the season does not pitch again in the majors after that year, and that was Matt Hall, you know your team was bad. And I always say the oral history of the 2020 Red Sox will be the greatest story I ever do someday. Couple of great, I'll give you two 2020 Red Sox stories.
This is good to end on. Very random, but I like it.
So I lived right near the ballpark that year, and there was no pregame access. I do the Zooms from home, walk over before first pitch. We're the only people allowed in, obviously. And I remember writing our lineup post game preview with one starting pitcher who I had barely ever heard of, maybe Mike Kickham, the lefty, used to be with the Giants.
He was a real prospect, pitched in the majors for
5 years, never did again.
Yep, lefty, I remember him.
By the time I got to the ballpark, they realized that part of the staff thought he was starting, part of the staff thought Robinson Lair, another guy who I barely have ever heard of, was starting, and they announced at like 6:40, actually, Robinson Lair starting this game. But I was like, do I even update the story? What is the point? Like, that's not even relevant to the result. Do you think like the Vegas line moved on that one or no? I think it probably stayed around.
Hey,
the same.
Hey, 2020 people. I mean, not that people aren't desperate to gamble now, but
no,
had nothing
true
to do. I mean, you might
I was nailing NASCAR DraftKings early 2020, by the way. And number two, this is the greatest. I mean, luckily he wasn't seriously hurt, but the greatest thing I've ever seen on a baseball field. They're down like 17-5 in the top of the ninth against the Rays. It was an afternoon game. They lost like 9 in a row. They're spiraling in August.
Eventual pennant winners, right? I mean, this is the Rays.
That's right.
Like, you're not
Hunter Renfro was going off. I think the Red Sox signed him based on that game alone. Yeah. So they're up like they're down really big in the ninth, and they decide to bring in Jose Peraza to pitch. Jose Peraza, second baseman, and was their opening day second baseman was terrible for them, like the rest of the team. He gets about 104 mile an hour comebacker off the shin, like the second pitch he throws. Fenway's empty, so he's like on the mound screaming. You can hear it. They have two teammates come to like literally carry him off, and Ron Renicki's out there shaking his head. Ron Renicki, the Red Sox manager, of course. He's shaking his head, and these two teammates carry him off. What happens next is Kevin Plawecki is behind the plate. Good guy. He drops all of his gear at the plate and walks out to the mound to pitch and starts warming up like he's playing, like he's doing a quick hands drill as his warm up. How fast can I get this and fire it in? He leaves his stuff behind the plate, and the catcher, I would guess Vasquez had already been in and out of the game and they were down to this. Zhu Wei Lin, who I don't think caught another second in the big leagues, gets behind the plate, puts on Plawecki's gear, doesn't fit. He's got all this stuff, and you have the Plawecki and Lynn battery finish that game out. And then we get on Zoom after, and Ron Renicki opens with, guys, I don't think it could possibly get any worse than this. Which so, he was correct. That was in the deer for the Boston Red Sox.
Looking at the box score, wild thing about this game is this was the middle of August. They still played another like month plus after this.
Is that Kyle Hart's debut?
There you go.
You know what? We're over time. I'll give you a bonus story on this. This is one of the
greats. This is good because Kyle Hart's going to get a major league deal here.
Great. He's a great guy. Kyle Hart making his major league debut. No one's allowed in the stands. His agent, Nello Gambardino, we were talking. He tells me, you know, what's interesting. Kyle Hart's whole family is flying into Boston for his debut, and they're going to watch the game through the gate at Bleacher Bar, which looks into the ballpark.
Yeah.
Bleacher Bar people are opening the gate. So they found this unbelievable cheat code. So they're watching through the garage door. And I go, oh my God, that's a great story. So as he's warming up in the first, I leave Fenway. I go out and interview his brother. Nello is out there. You know, what's it like? There's no fans allowed, but you are watching your brother's debut in person. Pretty interesting, unique story. I post a couple pictures. You know, this is August, high lockdown, especially in Boston. And I come back having tweeted a picture of some people inside Bleacher Bar. And the Red Sox organization, I started getting texts. Did you just go inside a crowded bar? Yeah, I was just in there for, you know, 10 seconds. And, you know, and then you came back inside Fenway? I said, yes, I was removed from the press box.
I was doing journalism.
I was doing journalism, but I was removed from the press box and had to watch the rest of that game outside alone.
You should have gone back to Bleacher Bar.
I know.
And watched with the hearts as Kyle Hart gave up a few home runs.
And now he's going to get his $24 million deal.
Probably not from the Boston Red Sox. Chris Cotillo.
Correct.
This was a joy.
It was.
I didn't expect to do too much 2020 Red Sox reminiscing, but I do think about that team. Probably more than I should.
As bad as it gets.
Yeah. Plug what you want to plug, and then we could say goodbye.
On Twitter at Chris Cotillo, rhymes with pillow, not Cotillo, as many people think. MassLive.com with Sean McAdam and Chris Smith. Everything Red Sox you could possibly imagine. And Sean and I do the Fenway Rundown podcast twice a week.
Chris, I'm proud of you. I appreciate you, man. Thanks for coming on, and we'll do this again next. We'll do this next winter, and we'll still talk about the 2020.
We'll do this in another 10 years. Yeah,
we'll be right back on Baseball Barbecue. And welcome back to Baseball Barbecue. Before we say goodbye, I want to take you around the league. We had a few transactions over the new year that we did not get to on my previous episode with Ben Nicholson Smith, and I wanted to give Kylie the opportunity to talk about Vidal Brujan. Okay, not quite yet. I know you're excited. I know you're excited to talk about Vidal Brujan. We're going to get there. First, I want to talk about the Pirates bringing back Andrew McCutchen and the Nationals signing Josh Bell and Trevor Williams. Why are those all related? Oh, but by Josh Bell and Trevor Williams, former Pirates. So there's a little bit of overlap there. But the reason I'm bringing up these two moves in tandem is because these are two teams that at this point, after some rough seasons, I mean, these were two of the worst teams in baseball for, you know, a good stretch there from, you know, 2020 to 2023-ish. Now, you would hope that this is when these teams should be pushing forward. Okay, we have a young core in place. The Nationals more so on the offensive side. Pittsburgh, obviously, on the pitching side. For you, Kylie, as someone who evaluates all levels of these organizations, which of these teams do you feel better about? Because these moves on their own do not necessarily suggest full throttle. We're going for it. It's time to win. Their spending patterns have certainly not indicated that. I know the Nats also traded for Nathaniel Lowe. Which of these teams are you more optimistic about? Let's just say for 2025, and then we can zoom out a little bit more.
Yeah, I would say the Pirates are closer because so I end up doing a lot of radio in towns where the big league team is not good. And I think they think that I'm going to come in and tell you that, like, you have the best farm system in baseball. You guys are going to be in the playoffs next year. And tell
it's a good gig.
Yeah, tell these guys you've never heard of. I'm like, guess what? They're all like, maybe good, maybe not. Like, that's all I can tell you. The thing that I think the fans don't realize is in those sorts of situations, having a bunch of top 100 guys that are maybe like a Kyle Teal kind of guy, where it's like probably not a roll seven or a roll eight, like, you know, MVP votes kind of guy. It's like a very likely to be a good everyday player, maybe an all-star, probably more very good everyday player. If you have a farm system full of, you know, seven of those guys, awesome. Most teams don't have that. That's maybe one of the top three farm systems in baseball, which is, I think, is technically true of the White Sox. I'll have to go through my whole system. The issue is if there's no superstars, if the whole team is between 1.5 to 3 WAR, you're not a playoff team. Like, you have to have a couple of stars, because the math is you have to have every backup and role player and middle reliever be really good. No one's below replacement level, and everyone is between 2 and 3 WAR. It's like the math doesn't really work. So you have to have some like 4 to 6 win players on true talent, not the Matt Duffy had a 4 WAR year 1 year. You have to have like a real guy. And so like the Nats have like James Wood could be that guy. Dylan Cruz could be that guy. As you kind of work down, like Susana, Travis Sikora, Brady House, CJ Abrams, like there are versions of this guy, but they have a lot of, I think this year, especially with like DJ Hurst and Mitchell Parker and Mackenzie Gore, a lot of guys that are now in that solid tier that are like there and good now. And so that's good to have. That gives you the high floor, but they don't have the stars, but they have the guys that could be stars. And you could imagine, given their history, that like, you know, there was rumors that they were on Bregman early in the process. I could see them spending some money. They've done this in the past. You can see the path to them being good. It looks sort of similar to how it did the last time when they had Strasburg and Harper and Soto and all those guys. So I think that they make some sense. I think they're like probably 2 years away from that. And I think they're acting that way. Whereas when you look at Pittsburgh, it's like, all right, O'Neill Cruz and Paul Skeens and, you know, maybe Cabrian Hayes or Brian Reynolds, they kind of have some of those like higher end guys already. And now with the Spencer Horwitz and the McCutcheon, they're trying to raise the floor and get those like second tier guys and the role players to be solid players, get the veterans in there, fill it out. Maybe Mitch Keller makes the big jump. Maybe David Bednar, you know. You can kind of see how that works. So I think because of that, Pittsburgh is a little ahead of them in the pecking order because it's a lot easier to fill out with those extra guys and have a couple prospects come up, and maybe Tamar Johnson rushes to the big leagues and is a pretty good player and has a chance to be a really good player. Finding those guys is a lot easier, and you can find them for 1 year at $7 million. Like, even smallest market teams can afford them. Whereas the Nats trying to find their six WAR guy, well, it can't afford it doesn't mean that they will. Whereas the Nats trying to find the six WAR guy, it could be James Wood, or maybe there's none of them in the organization and now they got to go pay $300 million for one. That's just a little further of a journey to go on.
Yeah. I'm interested in just the comparison of like, would you rather be the team that has too much pitching or too much hitting? Probably too much hitting. I mean, it's weird. Like, what establishes the higher floor? And obviously,
it's lower variance to have all your value being hitters.
And the other reason that's impossible to make this comparison is it's very different to be in the NL East than the NL Central. And I mean, that could be the difference, is that the Pirates maybe can get away with spending as little money as basically any team in the league, because the NL Central looks a lot more wide open. Whereas the Nationals, at some point, if they're going to want to have any chance of competing with Philadelphia, New York, Atlanta, it's probably going to take some more money than they actually have invested, at least recently. The Pirates are interesting. I mean, Hayes has gone backwards. Reynolds is still good, but it's hard to imagine him getting much better. Cruz is still as a wild card. I mean, Skeens, yeah, you have maybe the best pitcher in the world. So like, that is something that the Nationals do not have. Obviously, they have Dylan Cruz, his former teammate, who's good. We don't know. James Wood, I agree, is the one where it's like we could look up and, okay, now we are talking about that. But we don't necessarily see that. Pittsburgh, I'm still just looking at that system and I'm thinking, boy, Connor Griffin better be something. And he's probably one of the top 10 most interesting minor leaguers for 2025, because if we look up in a year and he's one of the top 20 prospects in baseball, that is another piece that you, again, he's years away, but it's still something offensively that you're looking forward to. Cause I don't know. I'm a lot lower on just Pittsburgh's ability to score runs anytime soon than what, cause just the way that Hayes is trended, and honestly, Cruz just as less of a sure thing. So they have the pitching, but I don't know, man. I just, again, the bar's a lot lower in that division. So maybe they can hang around. It's not like they were awful in 2024, but I don't know. I feel slightly better about, even though it will be a lot harder.
Yeah, I would say those two teams and maybe the Marlins will be the most interesting sort of rebuilds to see, like, does one of those three teams make the big jump forward where like three guys you weren't expecting become guys?
Well, yeah.
And like, but they all have so many good young players that any of them could be like the team that has the big jump forward.
That's true, but the Marlins, that's still more so at the minor league level, just because, like, yeah. I mean, they're with the White Sox are the two teams where it's like, we are going to be awful. Like, that the Pirates cannot be awful this year. Like, they might be.
Yeah, but their floors are much higher. They're almost certainly going to be better. One of the things I find interesting, which is, like, obviously not a thing that, like, a casual fan sees, is when a team is laugh out loud bad in last place, so Marlins or White Sox, it's they're at the front of the waiver order, the Rule 5 order. They get all the best minor league deal, you know, NRI guys. They pick at, you know, they have, like, the biggest pools generally. They pick at the top of the draft. Like, there's the things people know about, but there's those, like, second tier things that people don't realize where I'm like, I can almost guarantee you there's going to be some guy on a minor league deal that puts up 1.5 to 2.5 WAR for the Marlins this year that we are not paying attention to because when he signs, it's like, oh, yeah, it's just some guy. And really good teams, like the Brewers seem to, like, have two of those guys every year. And so if the Marlins are really good or the Pirates are Nationals, you can almost expect that they will have one. And if they have two, like, every year, then that's going to, like, tell you, like, oh, they're going to figure out how to do this. They don't have to have 17 top 100 prospects for this to turn into a good thing. And, like, with the Marlins, like, we don't really know yet. Whereas the Pirates and Nationals, it's like, oh, they've already, like, shown some signs and they have some guys and they don't have the, like, laugh out loud terrible guys on the roster right now. Whereas, like, the Marlins, like, I think the trade deadline, they had nobody left with more than, like, 1 year of service on the entire team.
No, I mean, now I feel like Lizardo was the last. I mean, God, the Sandy rumors are just depressing to think that they would trade him. But maybe. Whereas obviously, pretty much everybody else of any sort of veteran status has already been traded from Miami. But I do think that they're in a different bucket than Pittsburgh and Washington. But like I said, I think that the division will make a big difference there. Two more moves that I want to hit on. Well, one I just teased on, just because we mentioned the Marlins and the Cubs swung an interesting trade, Matt Mervis for Vidal Brujan. Mervis, he's going to get his chance now, right? He's going to get playing time in Miami, hopefully at some point in a way that he was not going to get in Chicago. Maybe he hits, maybe he doesn't. I wish him the best. Mash Mervis, God bless, do your thing. But Brujan is one that, like, he was on prospect list for a long time, and you just keep waiting. Like, when is this going to be anything? I know already, you know, I read Brett Taylor at Bleacher Nation being like, really? Like, this is the guy that that is, like, our bench guy? And maybe it is.
You need a new Nick Madrigal.
Right, exactly. But he can switch hit, I guess. So what is Brujan? I mean, is this someone that you could see? He's already, now this is his third organization. Why do teams keep thinking, like, this is the guy that could be something helpful?
So I'll take a step back from, like, these two guys specifically. I had a really interesting conversation with an exec about a year ago, and I was asking him, what are the kinds of players that are, like, the in vogue type of player that, like, the smart teams are going after, that they're kind of preying on the dumb teams, you know, in quotes. And he was saying that he has found, and, like, the organization has been talking about, how the strike zone, instead of being wide, has tended to get taller. And so what that has implied is that the Tyler Freeman, Vidal Brujan, Nick Madrigal, the kinds of guys where their value is in plate coverage and spraying the ball around and playing positions and being, you know, well-rounded and whatnot, those guys have less value, whereas a huge bat speed guy that maybe isn't a great player, like Nelson Velasquez, who just has crazy bat speed, where you're like, I don't know if this guy's any good. That guy has more value because that guy can work bottom to the top of the zone, doesn't really have any plate coverage, but, like, you don't have to cover that much at the plate anymore. And I think the game is generally getting more athletic as opposed to less athletic. And so the big, strong guys with big bat speed, the big, strong guys that throw hard and have a good slider are kind of bullying the, like, touch and feel command Kyle Hendricks types, the Vidal Brujan types. And there are obviously exceptions. Luis Arraez and Stephen Kwan fit into that bucket. The very best version of that guy obviously is always going to be valuable.
Anything less, though.
Yes.
That's the thing. If you're not Kwan or Arraez.
And we've talked before about, like, the sluggers that are on waivers or NRIs.
Well, we're about to get one. That'll be our last topic.
Like, those guys tend to be discarded quickly because if you're not hitting as the first baseman DH, you get thrown out immediately. And those guys often will come back because it's, you know, it's swing adjustment or whatever. Whereas the, like, second baseman that are little guys that can run, that are good base runners, that do a bunch of things, like, those guys don't get discarded. Like, Adrianza and Pedro Florimond, these guys, like, they hang around forever because everybody needs a guy like that. And if you can't hit, it kind of doesn't matter. And so there is something where if Vidal Brujan can do that thing that he was doing, like, 3 years ago in AAA when he was hitting and people kind of thought he might be that guy, the same way that I thought Nick Madrigal might be that guy, might be the exception. I think we're actually moving a little more toward the NFL, the NBA, where it's like the guys with the crazy measurables, maybe those are the guys you should be betting on rather than trying to find the exception and the different looking guy or be like, oh, this is the next Altuve or Dustin Pedroia or Mookie Betts. It's like, yeah, there's not like a fifth one of those guys. guys. There's like three of them, and that's it.
Right. And I, to your point, like the Quan and Arise, it's like, if you can do that, awesome. But expecting that the guy who's sort of like that is going to hit that 100th percentile outcome just seems kind of foolish. And instead, you have teams continuing to give chances to the likes of Eloy Jimenez, who the Rays gave a split deal, which means not guaranteed roster spot, but could make $2 million if he makes the team. And this is someone who is just, he has been very famous for a long time with the Cubs. Of course, with the White Sox, he gets this big extension. And then it just all goes very wrong. He's injured all the time. He is a very bad defender, obviously. He is like both lovable, but then obviously some fans are frustrated with him and saying that he's, you know, lazy and doesn't really care about this. But then he's also playing on the worst team in the history of the league. So it's like, can you blame him for not exactly having the best season this past season? And, you know, we might have similar conversations about Moncada at some point, you know, when he signs. But Eloy signs here with Tampa Bay. And again, he's only 28. So it's like he's not doomed. Like, it would not be shocking if he goes and hits 30 home runs this year. But as you mentioned, maybe teams are more interested in trying these guys again. But then also you could argue that there's some teams being like, we're not even going to bother, because if he isn't hitting, he is an absolute zero in a way that Brujan maybe can give you some other secondary skills.
So I have another like nugget of wisdom from front office. This is from like 10 years ago. And I was asking a team how they do minor league free agent signings. And one of those small market teams, one of those, you know, 5-7 teams that don't spend money. And they were like, when we're signing like our NRI first baseman, we are looking for variants. Like, if the guy is laugh out loud terrible and like needs to be released out of AAA, doesn't matter. Like, we don't owe that guy any money. We can go find somebody else. Those guys are easy to find that are good AAA players. If the guy is fantastic, that like changes the math for us. We got a guy that should have cost $20 million that's going to put up 2-something WAR, and we got him for free. And so these smaller market teams, when they get the NRIs, especially the ones with the big splits and stuff, they are looking for variants. And like, Eloy is one of those guys where it's like, if he put up a 4-WAR season where he like dominated in the way that he had earlier in his career, like, you'd be surprised. You would be shocked. You're like, I knew it was in there. He just found it. And maybe there was some injury he's playing through or whatever. Like, you could construct a world where that happens. And there is a long list. We were just going through it before we started recording, of like Carlos Pena, Nelson Cruz, Christian Walker. I mean, Jesus Aguilar had a couple years there. Like, these guys that are sort of hyped at one point and then don't do it. And then once they get to like arbitration or they're out of options, these guys get thrown in the discard pile. And they're like literal all-stars in that pile all the time. And it's usually first base, DH, left field, like these kinds of guys. But it's like a 1 in 15 shot that Eloy turns into that guy and gets the $60 million deal Christian Walker got. But like, this is the bucket where those guys come from.
And to that point, like, because of the risk involved and obviously his issue staying healthy, like, this is why he didn't get a guaranteed major league deal anywhere. But at the same time, it's not like he's that far removed from being an above average hitter. I mean, his exit velos and stuff are still top of the line, and he has generally always slugged enough to wear, you know, some of the plate discipline. And he's never really been a big strikeout guy either.
Yeah.
It's just the walks are sometimes down, and, you know, sometimes we're chasing a lot, and obviously if he's not hitting, he's not giving you anything else on the bases or defensively. And so it just looks bad. And obviously he ended up on a contract that was not reflective of the production that he was giving. But at 28, you know, I wouldn't be shocked at all if he goes and hits 30 homers this year.
One more visit to the, you know how I know I'm washed, is my first memory of Eloy Jimenez was going to a workout in the Dominican when I was a writer. And him and Gleyber Torres were the two big names. Like, oh, you can't believe like how good these guys are going to be. And I remember I was writing, I'll see if you can guess who it is. I was writing a scouting report when a guy was an A-ball that was like a rising prospect in the minors. It was a top 100 guy. And I was asking an international scout, like, hey, have I seen this guy before? He goes, yeah, he was on that field. Like, he is on your roster. I am sure you have a note about him. And so I went and found my notes, and I looked at my notes, and it just said, LOL question mark, where my notes are for this guy. Do you want to guess who that is?
Well, okay, so I'm kind of cheating because I've already pulled up who else was in that class. Was it Devers?
It was Ozzy Albies.
Oh!
Because he was like a foot shorter than everyone else. And it was like, he didn't run well. He didn't have BP. Like, he wasn't even playing shortstop. I was just like, what is this guy doing here? And then he didn't hit in the game. And so it's like, in a workout atmosphere, he signed for whatever it was, $200,000, and he's a tiny dude with no tools. It was just like, well, what am I supposed to take from this? Like, why is this guy out here? And there were a bunch of dudes that signed for $2 million that didn't make it out of A-ball all those sorts of guys. But yeah, he was... And because he's probably now the best guy from that event. And I like didn't even pay attention to him because I was like, what was I supposed to take from this?
Yeah.
which is why scouting is sometimes terrible. Yes. I spent so much money going down there to see these guys and completely whiffed on the best player.
You didn't think Mike Iridolfo was going to become a real thing? Yeah. Yeah, there's all kinds of guys from that class. I don't know what Martin Gasparini is up to. I imagine the Italian shortstop was not at that workout. But anyway, Kylie, that was a hilarious note to end on. If you want to hear more of Kylie's wisdom, go buy his book with Eric Longenhagen, Future Value.
That's
the very good
one back here.
The yellow, yeah. It's a good book. If you want to learn a lot about baseball and read great stories about JT Realmuto in high school, I recommend it.
Scouts hiding in bushes watching JT Realmuto.
That's exactly right. But Kylie, we appreciate your insight. Thank you for doing this with me. Thank you to Chris Cotillo for talking to the Red Sox. That was talking about the Red Sox. That was very much enjoyable. You can read Kylie on ESPN. See him on ESPN sometime. ESPN Plus, you can read all of his wonderful words. I appreciate his insight, and he has been a good friend to me for quite a long time, as you can probably tell. So, Kylie, thank you so much for joining us on Baseball Arborcast. I hope it was an okay time, and we'll do it again in 10 years, all right?
Yeah, I hope you hadn't heard all of those stories before. I knew you'd heard some of them before.
only so. I actually had not heard that Aussie one, believe it or not. But thank you so much for the time. We appreciate it. Thank you to producer Andrew Hartz for making this show possible. And Jake will be back next week, but don't worry, he'll still be in Thailand.